solution is love, I argue with Roberto. From the slick-tiled patio, where houseplants as big as elms sway in a somber breeze at 4 or 5 in the Manaba morning. And watch Pedro follow Diane up her brown arm to the place inside her ear where he isn't speaking revolution. And Alonzo tosses in the rhetoric made of too much rum and the burden of being an American in a country he no longer belongs to. What we are dealing with here are ideological differences. Political power, he says, to impress a woman who is gorgeously intelligent and who reminds me of the soft Tau desert of a lover's cheek. She doesn't believe anything but the language of damp earth beneath a banana tree at noon, and will soon disappear in a screen of rum with a man who keeps his political secrets to himself in favor of love. I argue with Roberto and laugh across the continent to Diane, who is on the other side of the flat round table, whose surface ships would fall off of if they sailed to the other side. We are Anishinaabe and Muskogee. We have wars of our own. Knowing this, we laugh and laugh until she disappears into the poinsettia forest with Pedro, who is still arriving from Puerto Rico. Doesn't leave the bow of the slippery ship. This is a land of revolution. You can do anything you want, Roberto tries to persuade me. I fight my way through the cloud of rum and laughter, through lines of Spanish and spirits of the recently dead, whose elbows rustle the palm leaves. It is almost dawn, and we are still a long ways from morning, but never far enough to get away. I awake in a story told by my ancestors, when they spoke a version at the very beginning of how so long ago we climbed the backbone of these torturous Americas. This is not a foreign country, but the land of our dreams. I listen to the gunfire we cannot hear and begin this journey with the light of knowing the root of our own furious.
And good morning. Yes, we are here. It was an extended musical introduction by Joy Harjo and Poetic Justice with The Real Revolution is Love. And I am Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am waiting for my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who's coming in from the Hillsboro area. Maybe she's got some dense fog. Anyway, hopefully she will be here momentarily. And we have Faith Spotted Eagle, who's going to be calling in. Hopefully that will all just come together. So we were going to talk about a bunch of stuff that I don't feel entirely comfortable talking about by myself, but we're going to continue to talk about the situation at Standing Rock, but in the context of the new regime. And some talk that's been going around that a Trump presidency could bring back the termination era. So I'm going to talk about termination here because if you don't know about it, you really ought to. It set the context for what that might mean. There's been talk of privatizing the oil reserves on the oil rich and possibly also other mineral reserves on the reservations, because it turns out that Native nations actually have within their boundaries, and certainly within their traditional treaty territories, large percentages of the mineral wealth of the United States. In fact, the United States as a world power rode on the back of forced labor, slavery, and not just the expropriation, theft of indigenous lands, but the massive resources that they had no way of knowing were there, and really waited until the Industrial Revolution to be able to make use of many of them, including oil, coal, copper, iron, and other ones that, as I said, led to the United States becoming a world power. And Native Americans, those that weren't entirely or either killed off or basically disbanded as functioning tribal entities, of course, most of them have remained, but those ones who remained either through warfare or negotiation or whatever, many of them were shunted off onto less than desirable lands. There's very few federally recognized reservations in the East, obviously the Iroquois being an exception. Many of them that now exist in the East had to be reinstated through a long and arduous process of a federal recognition through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, formerly the War Department. So the termination period, again, you know, there's this long, long period of history that Jacqueline knows so much better than me, and hopefully she'll be getting here any minute now, or call in at least. So after the period of warfare, the treaties and a confinement to reservations, and then a number of other periods, there's a demographic resurgence after the beginning of the 20th century, just before and after. And many tribes, and some of those who were forcibly relocated to Oklahoma Territory, rebuilt themselves. Some for the second or third or even fourth time had to rebuild themselves. And then in the 1950s, the Watkins, believe a congressman from Utah, pushed the not getting it here on this article. Anyway, this is called the Bosone Bill, Termination of Indian Treaties, written in October 29, 2016 by Dr. Dean Chavers. I'm not sure exactly the source, but I'm sure you can find it. But there's much written about. I'm just going to start reading this. Franklin D. Roosevelt and his Commissioner of Indian Affairs, John Collier, had a highly supportive attitude towards Indians. President Harry S. Truman had his hands full with international problems, the governing of Germany and Japan, the Berlin airlift of 1848, testing the atomic bomb, and constant harassment from Republicans. Isn't that new? And mostly had a hands-off attitude toward Indian affairs. When he had the time to think about Native Americans, Truman revealed himself to be a total assimilationist, as all the presidents had been for three-quarters of a century. That was largely the policy, of course, is either completely destroy their culture through violent means or assimilate them through the boarding school and other attempts to make them, quote, regular Americans. And so that assimilation policy was basically the guiding force until relatively recently. Right after World War II, a conservative reaction started to sit in around the nation. Politicians were reacting to big government, socialism, communism, welfare recipients, ain't these new, foreigners, non-English speakers, liberals, and civil rights groups. One of the first actions in Congress was the hearings by Senator William Langer of North Dakota in 1947 to reduce the size of government. As the chairman of the Civil Service Committee, Langer brought in BIA to testify about its operations, that's Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the number of employees it had. After 2 days of testimony, he advocated abolishing the BIA and letting Indians take care of themselves. President Dwight D. Eisenhower and his Western Republican henchmen took a decidedly anti-Indian approach. They went beyond assimilation to trying to take away what little remaining resources Indians still had. When Eisenhower took office in 1953, he had majorities in both the Senate and the House. These majorities could and did ride roughshod over several groups and issues, including Native Americans. They believed it was their right and duty to reverse Roosevelt's New Deal. This is all very resonant with what's happening right now. He put the former head of the Japanese internment camps, Dillon Meyer, to run the BIA. The Republicans believed in less government. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was one of their favorite agencies to belittle. Few of them mouthed racist arguments, but all of them mouthed anti-government arguments. And Eisenhower signed all the dozens of Indian termination bills that made it to his desk. It was not always conservative Republicans who advocated termination. In fact, the first termination resolution was introduced in 1950 by a liberal Democratic member of Congress, Reverend Representative Reva Beck Bosson. In addition to being the first woman elected to Congress from Utah, Bosson had been the first woman judge in Salt Lake City. She'd also been a member of the Utah legislature, and like Vivian Watkins, she had no previous experience in Indian affairs. Her Bosson bill would have authorized the BIA to study tribes to determine which ones were ready for termination. Indians would have had to agree to be terminated, and tribes would have had to be ready for termination. Could put that in quotes, ready, whatever that means. All right. Watkins, who over the years would allow no one to challenge his primacy over Indian affairs, opposed Bosson's termination bill, House Joint Resolution 490, and it was defeated. Bosson, who had expected to have his support, was surprised. His opposition was strictly about power and control. Anyway, this goes on and on. So Representative William Henry Harrison of Wyoming introduced House Concurrent Resolution 108 on June 9, 1953. Harrison's great-great-grandfather of the same name was the ninth president. Harrison was only a sophomore representative. This is all getting a little long here, but HCR 108 was a resolution expressing the sense of both legislative bodies and not a legislative act of either house. It did not in itself terminate any Indian treaties. Each tribe that was terminated had to have a separate bill passed in both houses of Congress and signed by the president to break its treaty. HCR passed on August 1, 1953, less than 2 months after it was introduced. There was, in effect, almost no opposition to the resolution. And my co-host, Jacqueline, has arrived. And I don't know if she's been listening, but we're talking about termination here. And I'm reading from this article, the Bosson Bill, Termination of Indian Treaties, which basically set the stage for individual termination bills, including many bills here in Oregon. Oregon was the hardest hit of all the states in terms of the termination policy, which continued into the, I believe, the 1960s. So let me just jump to the end of this, and you can jump in any time. Good morning.
Good morning.
Congress and the president terminated 179 Indian tribes following the passage of HCR. This is the last paragraph, 108. Most of them are still terminated. My tribe, the Lumbee Nation, is the only tribe that was federally recognized and terminated in the same piece of legislation. Indians must be continually alert to the threats of termination, which are still around. And of course, Oregon has not only unfortunately led the way in terms of terminating tribes, it has actually also led the way in terms of reinstatement. But the cost, both to the unity of the people and the physical lives, culture, family structure of the Native peoples who are terminated almost no way of expressing that. I've talked to a number of people over the years from Klamath, Siletz, Grand Ronde, whose personal families suffered just tremendously. Much of the Native population in Portland is here because of the termination policies, in addition to other federal policies, relocation included. So we're talking about the history, a little bit about the history of termination, to set the stage for the talk that's going on in the Trump camp. I actually didn't read enough into it to actually get where that's actually coming from. But there's been a number of articles talking about the possibility of bringing back termination, specifically with the design to privatize resources, which is why we're talking about in the context of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Yeah. You know, in light of that, it's very interesting. Just a couple of days ago, my aunt, Faith Spotted Eagle, who may be calling in on the show soon, was actually became the first Native woman to receive an electoral college vote for the president of the United States. And so I'm really proud of her for that. It was actually given to her by an elector in Washington State, Robert Satayakum, who is Puyallup, and whose family was very involved with the Fishens there. And when I interviewed, when I talked to my aunt that day after she had heard, she had no idea that was going to happen. And she, you know, when I talked to Robert, he said that that he was inspired to do it by being at the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, encampment there, the at Standing Rock, and he was there when they. When they raise the horn, and the horn is a traditional encampment within the encampment, a Dakota Lakota encampment that is actually pointed at in the shape of a horn and pointed at the enemy. It's sort of an act of a protection and maybe defiance. And so they raise the horn at the end of October, and he was there, and my aunt gave a speech about the role of women, and of how women are represented by the teepee, when the teepee covers and protects the people as women do. And he was struggling with what to do with his vote as an elector in this process in the U.S. Presidential election. And he said at that moment it crystallized in his mind what he needed to do with his vote. And he chose to vote for my Aunt Faith as the President of the United States, and Winona LaDuke as Vice President. I think that what you see happening at Standing Rock as a counterpoint to what's happening, what happened and may happen again with termination, the continued desire of the colonial government to make us disappear. You know, the Indian problem is really about legitimacy of the United States, claims to the land that indigenous nations still retain under treaty. And so when Satayakum gave his vote to my aunt, he was giving his vote to our people, to our people's sovereignty, to our to the justice that we deserve, and the right of our nations to exist. And so and what termination is all about is the power to make people disappear, inconvenient people, which is pretty much all the nations, you know, the 566 federally recognized tribes and many more nations that are not recognized federally or by the states, you know, to make us kind of disappear from the political landscape, and all our troublesome claims to land and that undercut the legitimacy of the United States. The colonial power of the United States, make it go away. And they'd hope that, you know, like 100 years ago in 1916, they were writing about how the Indian was disappearing, going off into the sunset, and they were even going to build a big memorial to us on the East Coast to our disappearance, and which, of course, they engineered. And you know, but here we are, more than, you know, there's more than us, more than in a long time, I mean, you know, and you know, there are, I think, over almost close to 200,000 Dakota, Lakota people in all the different reservations and reserves in the United States and Canada, and these sort of islands that remain to us of our own lands. And yeah, and the Ocheti Shakoan, the Great Sioux Nation, the Seven Council Fires, is reemerging as a political force in the 21st century.
So there's so many different things to talk about on this subject. I just wanted to, again, sort of just to give the what the basic historical reality is. of the term. What termination did is it took away federal recognition. So talk a little bit about maybe the origins of federal recognition. I know you've talked already, both when you were a guest and as a co-host, on the importance of the relationship between the nation-to-nation relationship, the whole basis of sovereignty, which is involved in, well, it is and it isn't involved in federal recognition. And there's a whole evolution of federal Indian law, which we can go over again because it's I don't know how much it sticks in people's minds who aren't really close to this stuff. But so federal recognition is key to getting a whole series of education, health, whole series of basic support structures, and also basically allowing that, it guarantees certain treaty rights to different tribes, you know, on different bases because all the treaties are different. And it also, you know, guarantees that tribes will be relatively left alone in what remains of their actual land basis that's held in trust by the federal government. So
yeah, I think that one of the basic things that needs to change, one of the things that need to change is Americans' understanding of tribes. Tribes not as sort of like little special groups that are left over with sort of parks, national parks of their own, but tribes as nations, as sovereign nations. And and you know, I was just at Standing Rock. I just got back last week, and it was very, very cold there. And it was, with wind chill factor easily below negative 20 degrees. And you know, when you take your, it's so cold there, like when I would take my hand out of my glove, like to operate my camera or whatever, you know, within 5 minutes, my hand would be like in physical pain. And it's just that cold. You can't even, you know, not wear a face mask. And I felt there that, you know, it was like, it just reminded me all the whiteness and the extreme temperature really reminded me of Hoth, you know, with Star Wars, the winter planet Hoth. And it felt like what we were was what our camp there is a rebel camp, a camp in defiance of the empire and the empire, I guess, of Trump and of oil and of excess and an empire fueled by the appropriation of our lands and our resources. While I was there, I saw a friend of mine. I had first met her at actually a Cleveland Indians protest in Cleveland when she was a Native graduate student there at Case Western, leading the student body to oppose Chief Wahoo. And she was there, and now she's working at the Navajo Nation, and she's an engineer, and you know, she's Ojibwe. And we were talking we were looking at the treaties, the Fort Laramie treaties they contain the recognition. Oh, Faith is here. Okay, let's put her on then. Actually, my Aunt Faith has just called in. So, you know, let's
put her on. Okay. Well, hello, Faith, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Auntie.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes. So, how are you doing? We just the announcement that you were the first Native, Native person to receive a vote, an electoral college vote for president of the United States. How are you feeling?
Well, that's definitely a new experience. What can I say?
So, were you expecting this?
Of course not. It's not like anybody expects that, but it was like getting a rose. It was a nice rose.
What? So how do you think this do you think this has helped draw attention to the issues of Native people and the issues of pipelines?
I think for that part, I think it's totally amazing that Robert was able to. It sounds like at the very last minute, he summoned it up and put my name in there. And I think it's really brought attention to the environment. And in a lot of the, I've just been, reporters have been calling from all over, so I just quit answering. But I told them when they called me an environmentalist is a human being. And hopefully they're human beings too. So it gives an opportunity to draw attention that being an environmentalist should be a very common thing.
That's very
so
true.
That's my thought for the day.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, how do you feel that, you know, how do you feel that this, that the movement that you've been part of with Fighting Keystone XL and also the Dakota Access Pipeline, how do you feel that's inspired Indian Country?
I think that the important thing to keep in perspective in a humble way is that I'm only one of 10,000 or so people that came to an intersect that was so historical and actually was the culmination of years and years of prayers and actions that have led to this point and in a time of urgency. So I think to keep that in perspective and that we can't turn back, we just have to keep going. And I know that people will get discouraged. You know, other people will step into the light and will want to take the labor of others, but it doesn't really matter because if you've done something, you know it. Mm-hmm. And that's the important thing. You just keep on doing it.
Yeah, I should tell for our audience, you know, what your role has been. Faith Spadigal is my aunt, and she's also a member of the Hanktawan, the Yankton Sioux tribe in South Dakota. And she has been a leader in the fight against pipelines coming through our lands. She was a major organizer with the Keystone XL pipeline and helped put together the coalition of non-native landowners and also tribes to fight that pipeline successfully. And she is now, she's an elder and she's also a member of the Black Hills Treaty Council and an elder at the Ocheti Shakowin camp at Standing Rock right now, and has been an amazing force of wisdom, of traditional knowledge. She is a fluent speaker of our language. I think both Dakota and Lakota, right?
Yeah. It's just a dialectal difference, so it's all the same to a certain extent. But rather than talking about me, I'm interested in who else is on the program.
Oh, actually, she wasn't able to come in, so okay. We were hoping to have Zinkala Mapia Wee Black Owl. And yeah. She is a young woman who is actually a relative of ours, who lives here in Portland, Oregon, who gave birth at the Ocheti Shakowin camp at Standing Rock to a baby, the first baby born there, and the baby's name is Mini Wichoni, which means water is life.
Yes.
Yeah. She's sick this morning, so she wasn't able to come in. So, and
yeah, everybody has the camp cough. I believe I have it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you were able to escape it.
I'm hoping I have. I'm not sure yet. So, but
yes.
But yeah. What is that? I mean, the camp, you know, actually grew to 10,000 people on December 5th, and became a city of its own. Like, I think this is by far the largest encampment of our people in over 150 years.
I think that there probably was a similar camp. Is Jennifer Baker on?
No, she can't. She couldn't call in either. She okay. actually had to
okay.
end the meeting.
There was a similar encampment in 1851. According to both oral and written reports, that when the 1851 treaty was signed in Fort Laramie, a call had gone out from Indian agents to our people that they were going to negotiate a very important, what they call Wo'apisuta, hard paper is what it means, is a hard document. And so for the summer before and the year before, people went out to all the camps and said that the agents were going to try to do something. And of course, there was a sense of trepidation that once again, they would try to do something without their presence. So they wanted to make sure that they were present during this time. And so there were like 10,000 natives that gathered at the Fort Laramie 1851 treaty. So I think it's kind of a, I don't know what you would call it, wonderful, miraculous reflection of history that there were two gatherings. I don't know how many years apart that is, but around 10,000, if you can imagine a camp that large negotiating a treaty.
That's amazing.
And so it did happen in 1851 for the purpose of reserving our right to this traditional territory.
And is this treaty, the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, that is being invoked now
yes.
For consultation rights over the pipeline?
Yes. And there's the interesting thing to keep in mind when you refer to a treaty. Usually a treaty is a cession document, meaning that when people want to sign a treaty, they usually want something. And so often it ends up being a compromise, which has not always been favorable to our people, because once the other side gets what they want, they forget about the compromise on the other side, which is the famous story of the broken treaties. And so when the document was signed, it was for certain things in the treaty, and those things that were not mentioned still remain as rights to our people, and they are referred to as reserved rights or usufructuary rights. And so we maintain a lot of rights in that area that were not part of the 1851 treaty that we believe is unceded rights. And in addition to that, if you're not a member of a family that signed the treaty, then you come from a family that has not ceded anything. Hmm. For example, in the 1868 treaty, the Ihangtuan didn't sign the 1868, so that treaty doesn't have application to us. So there's territory that probably was ceded that we did not cede because we did not sign that treaty. So it's kind of complicated. You have to weed through it. You have to, put layers of maps over it and decide what is the best position to take. The dangerous thing about the treaty is that when you're dealing with people who have no conception of what our world is, an example being yesterday when the word got out that I had received one electoral vote, I think it was in Seattle or somewhere, they were saying that my name was an imaginary name. And so when I mentioned it to my son, he said, well, in their world, you're imaginary. And so I think in their world, treaties are imaginary. It's like they don't recall that those were real documents. But when you think about the treaties that are signed with Canada, China currently, mm-hmm. they certainly honor those because they have the might of resources and economy.
Well, that's the whole... Yeah, I think that is part of what I hope that Americans learn from what is happening at Standing Rock, is that our nations are actual real nations. They're suppressed, and that the U.S. has had a policy of sort of clouding our existence. And because, of course, our existence threatens the legitimacy of the United States to a certain extent.
Yeah, it was a path of legal genocide that was well planned out, and it is reinforced with each administration from the presidential level that comes in. So if you look back in history, every four-year period that came in, everybody decided they wanted to save the Indians or straighten out the Indians or solve the Indian problem. So we have to do this crazy dance every 4 years. And sometimes some of those actions are in direct opposition to what we've been doing for the previous 4 years, or maybe sometimes 20 years, when somebody gets a bright idea that these imaginary Indians need to do this in order to become non-native people.
So,
an example being that Trump's administration has had discussions on defederalizing our land. Mm-hmm. And that's something that native people have talked about for a long period of time. That was the controversy surrounding Cobell, that if you put everything into trust, at any point Congress can come in with their plenary power and wipe that out, which it would be a horrible human right violation to do that. But when you have people who have no clue about themselves and think that they have power and greed over everyone else, they'll do some real crazy things. And so it's going to be the fight of our lives for the next 4 years.
With the Trump administration coming in and yes. knowing nothing yes. about our status as nations and
right.
and recognizing our treaties. That yeah. it is
and
really...
all for the sake of money. And so because America is so short-sighted and always worrying, I think the people nowadays think in 1 week to 2 week terms when their next paycheck, because there's some studies that say that the majority of people, if their paychecks were cut off, in a 2-week period. There's not very many that would live beyond that 2-week period in a comfortable way that they're used to. And so people get frantic every time they think they're not going to get their next paycheck, and they are ready to sell their soul for whatever they think is appropriate.
Well, I think that really points out the difference between our culture, the Dakota, Lakota culture, and the one that is preeminent now, dominant now, is that, and I think that's what is really fascinating about living back in a camp circle society like our ancestors did, is that suddenly people become valued for other reasons, for who they are, rather than, you know, a paycheck or, you know, yeah, this sort of focus on us as consumers, you know, Americans as consumers, that rather than as people with relationships, yeah, with each other.
Jacqueline, I'm going to have to leave. I'm in a general council meeting of our people. So talk about a peer democracy. So that's what we're a non-Indian reorganization tribe. So that's happening right now. So I'm going to have to check out, but I appreciate the time to greet your listeners and just ask them to keep on standing up for Mother Earth, especially today is winter solstice. So Mother Earth is repositioning herself today. So it's the shortest day of the year, so make the best of it in a good way.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it, Auntie.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that was Jacqueline Keeler, my co-host's aunt, Faith Spotted Eagle, calling in from North Dakota.
South Dakota.
South Dakota.
Yehonktowan territory.
And so I want to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show, and the number to call in is 503-231-8187. I got a note from a listener who would like my email, and I have given out a special KBOO email in the past, and I haven't been looking at it recently. I will attempt to reorient myself in that direction. So anybody wants to get in touch with me, it's Paul R. KBOO, all together, Paul R. KBOO at gmail.com. So, you know, Jacqueline, there's something so eerie about the fact that this Dakota Access pipeline fight has just become what it is, at the same time as this whole election campaign was going, and this Trump has been elected, and that Trump has these major oil industry connected figures in his cabinet, you know, Rick Perry, then his Secretary of Agriculture is a Forrest Lucas, founder of Lucas Oil Products, and then you've got
is it the CEO of Exxon as Secretary of State?
Secretary of State. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't forget that. And the administrator of EPA is Scott Pruitt from Oklahoma. And of course, the whole history of oil in Oklahoma and the devastation to the tribes
Osage
there. Just another whole story. So it's just very eerie that this is all coming down this way. And then you look at articles like Donald Trump's long history of clashes with Native Americans. Just he's actually we had a caller earlier. I don't know if Tim is still there, but so I just want to mention those things. But do we have a caller? Okay, are you still there? Are you with us the full time, Tim?
Yeah, I'm here.
Sorry to keep you waiting for so long. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hey. So along with termination comes loss of land base and BIA funding, right? So would it be possible for a tribe to set up a nonprofit parallel to the BIA thing, where they could start transferring lands into the nonprofit and hold it as a private land, so if the tribe was disbanded, it wouldn't affect that? They'd still be able to hold it, and then they could build on that base.
Well, I think that the concept of holding it in trust means that the federal government is the actual owner, the U.S. federal government. I think that if termination were attempted today, that you would see similar standoffs as what is happening right now at Standing Rock, all over the country. I don't think that in today's day and age that any tribe would allow their land to be taken without a fight, without some sort of, occupying the land, refusing to give it up. We live in a very different time than the 1950s, And I think that the tribes have evolved in political power and size and such since then. When termination happened, actually, my great aunt, her name was Helen Peterson, and she was the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, and she was a fairly young woman, and she actually she's Oglala Lakota, and she drove around the country in a beat up old car with her son, and went to each tribal council and convinced them to not accept termination. And she really helped organize the fight against termination. And so it's, I think that nowadays, I don't think we would need someone to drive around and tell tribal councils not to accept termination. I think that it's a very different time now. And so I think that, and with the unity of the tribes in fighting against Standing Rock, you see all the hundreds and hundreds of flags, each of them from a different tribal, a different indigenous nation, backed by actual like formal tribal resolutions of support. The tribes are more unified than ever, and I think they will fight this in a way that they would never fight it before, and I don't think they would look to incorporating under a colonial Internal Revenue Service code to defend their rights. I think that they will seek real sovereignty and hold the U.S. accountable on the international stage.
Well, I hope so. I really do.
Yeah, I do too.
Well, thank you for calling.
Okay, take care.
And for waiting for so
yes,
long.
Yes, thank you so much.
503-231-8187. So, again, it really bears continually repeating. So that was an interesting question. And so the federal government owns the land and holds it, quote, in trust, which is an interesting term, for the different Native nations.
Yes.
And that's rests upon, I don't know if people heard two Mondays ago, a week and a half ago on the Old Mole, they had a tape of Joe DeGaudi, the Yakima Nation tribal chairman, running down the whole history really clearly of the whole origins of federal Indian law in the doctrine of discovery. So basically, once Europeans supposedly discovered this land, which was supposedly like not, either empty or not fully or well utilized, supposedly according to their ideology, by the native peoples, which somehow gave them the right to own it. So because they basically, because God, I think the rationale is like God is the owner of the earth, and the Christians had this direct line to God. So they, therefore they could own.
You're talking about the doctrine of discovery.
The doctrine of discovery. They could
yeah.
own the land. So that's why, Native Americans were treated basically as wards of the state, as children.
Yeah, so. I think that with the Doctrine of Discovery, you have Chief Justice John Marshall, the very first Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice of the United States, of a brand new country, a country that has no legal history. And he has to sit down and create and fabricate some sort of legal, precedents to draw upon. And, I think he's faced with a case in the 1830s, actually, where you have two men, two white men, who have received titles to land, deed titles to land. One is from, I think, the Cherokee Nation, and the other one is from the state of Georgia. And he has to decide which title is more valid, right? And so he looks at everything, and he's drawing upon English common law. He's looking at different legal systems around the world, and he finds this papal law, this obscure papal law from like 1492, which states that only discovering nation, European Christian nations, have when they land on some land, if there are no other Christian, if it's not owned by other Christian nations, that the actual fee simple title of the land reverts automatically to them. And so he cites this law as the reason why the state of Georgia's, as part of the United States, and the United States being an inheritor nation of this status as a discovering Christian nation, has their title that they issue is more valid than that of the indigenous nation itself, that the Cherokee Nation actually enjoys no fee simple title to the land because they were not Christian European discovering nations. And so the U.S. is one of a few colonial states, including, I think, New Zealand and Australia, that cites this law. And they still cite it to this day. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg cited it in 2011, you know. And basically, this is a massive human rights violation. Every people in the world should enjoy title to their land. And he says that that Native Americans only have the title to the land, only enjoy the right of occupancy and use of the land like animals do. And so this equation of Native American tribes, sort of like herds of animals across, you know, the landscape, is sort of encoded into law and is still law today in the United States. The issue is that colonial law, the sole purpose of colonial law is delegitimizing Native nations' land rights and political existence. So we can't look to them to solve the problem because they are the problem.
So I want to just bracket this thought before we go to Deanna in a second. So as I recall, that whole issue of fee simple title and land rights was like the major sticking issue in the negotiations over the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in the United Nations. And of course, they never got that. That was one thing that none of those, it never would have come to be if they were given that fee simple title.
The issue is that I think that that this whole idea that the United States holds our lands in trust is based on the idea of the doctrine of discovery, and it's a human rights violation. I think that the U.S. should give up the pretense of holding our lands in trust and recognize our sovereignty and our, you know. And the treaties are all about sovereignty. I mean, the U.S. Senate does not ratify treaties with anyone else but other sovereign nations. And under international law, you cannot sign away your sovereignty. So, you know, signing a treaty is an act of sovereignty, not an annihilation of it. And so, the U.S. needs to actually stop pretending that these lands are theirs and that they have ultimate say over them. And they need to follow international law and actually stop suppressing Native nations and recognize their legal rights.
And of course, going into the Trump era, all those things are going to be on the table or off the table, as the case may be. So let's go to Deanna. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you both. These conversations that you have are so helpful and so important for all of us who listen and care about this. So I'm really glad you're having them. And when I called, I was thinking about what I think Jacqueline was just talking about. I was thinking the very idea that the United States thinks it owns any of the land is wrong. So I don't know if that makes it any difference on how you fight it, because of course they're pretty powerful. But the idea, I mean, it seems to me that none of the land here is owned by the thing called the United States. It's all Indian country and Indian territory. One of the questions that I'd love to have a response to that, but the other question I have is those of us who are really trying our best to be supportive in this battle for sovereignty, who are not Native, I would like to know the best way, you know, right now for us to help, and I wondered if Jacqueline would address that at some point.
Yeah, I think the best way to help would be definitely to help educate and to demand that the United States honors the treaties and recognizes the full sovereignty of these nations that the U.S. has actively suppressed. I think that the U.S. holds itself up internationally as the arbiter of morality around the world, particularly political morality, and it's. I think that it needs to be held accountable for this. I definitely agree with the notion that the U.S. I call the U.S., the United States, a colony without portfolio. which is a colony without a homeland. And once they, you know, broke off from the British, they became homeless in a sense. And the only lands that the United States possesses are the lands of Native nations. And I think that it's time for Americans to really come to terms with that. What Trump ran on was sort of a mythology of an origin story and a notion of the United States. And it's ironic to note that Trump, his family have only lived in the United States pretty much since the in the 20th century. They're very recent immigrants. They've never fought in any of these wars. They weren't around when the Indian Wars were going on. They were definitely in Europe during that time. And the sense of entitlement they have to our lands, to the United States, really is fed by the mythology of colonialism and white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jacqueline.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling, Deanna. 503-231-8187. We're a little late getting to callers, but we have a few minutes left. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the Project Censored Show on Political Perspectives. At 10, as always, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, Haiti's fight for democracy continues as the people fight back against fraudulent elections. Hopefully they'll do a better job than we have been here. At 11 on The Food Show, we'll hear from Farmers Ending Hunger, Organic Ology, the Organic Food Conference, and Taste and Technique, the new cookbook aimed at helping the home cook take their practice to the next level. And as always, thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. A reminder that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched one-to-one through the end of the year, thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. And you can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. You know, this whole idea that you're putting out there, this whole idea of the rule of law, international law, these are things, human rights, things that, people have had to struggle for decades and centuries to get respected. And then, you know, you think that you've made some progress. And then all of a sudden, as your aunt was saying, you know, after, you know, 1 4-year cycle or a 20-year policy cycle, whether it's, you know, self-determination inaugurated by Nixon or whatever, all of a sudden it seems like it's all up in the air again. And, you know, it seems like, you know, what happened, the comparisons being made between Trump and, you know, Mussolini and Hitler about fascist rules is the idea that basically what those regimes do is they rip off the mask of the rule of law. What seemed like, you know, these painfully enacted protocols for how to deal with each other, procedures for, you know, going to court, for all sorts of things, get thrown out. And you have a much more brutal gloves off approach to people. And then, you know, people who have been protected by dominant forces, because obviously with the Europeans, population explosion, which has made it so different from the white South Africans, which always ruled as a very small minority, whereas here the, you know, white Europeans had this massive population expansion and ended up outnumbering.
Well, and also immigration laws favored Northern Europeans over any other group.
So you know,
it's an artificially
minorities
created
have had to, you know, so-called minorities and indigenous populations have had to, you know, basically fight to get whatever protections they had. And now it seems like something like Trump could.
Well, I think what the difference we have from, you know, what happened in Europe in World War II is that we have tremendous allies. And I think you see that visible in Standing Rock, as well as the militarized violence. I mean, I feel like the militarization of the police response makes the military occupation of our lands visible for everyone to see. Because, of course, no DAPL demonstrators in Iowa who are mostly white U.S. citizens are not facing that level of violence, and that certainly didn't happen here in Oregon with Mal Heuer. Although when I interviewed Burns Paiute Tribal Chairwoman Charlotte Roderick, she definitely told me, she said, if we took that over, we would be faced with guns if we took over the wildlife refuge. We have another caller.
Let's go to our last quick caller, Gretchen, and you got only a minute.
Hello, Gretchen.
Taking my call. Thank you for your program. I would like to know how this reflects also on the eminent domain law that's being used to take other people's land and the object of sovereign rights. Can we not do this in international court so that we literally trump the Trump, if you get my idea?
Yes, yeah.
Well, the U.S. didn't sign the criminal, you know, isn't part of the criminal court.
Yeah, I think the international enforcement is very weak. I think that it's very difficult that way. I think that what we are looking at is unification of purpose with other Americans who and a greater educated force of Americans to understand our situation and to hold the U.S. accountable, and maybe even alter what the U.S. is and means. I think we've come to that point where, it's very interesting you mentioned eminent domain, because I'll try to say this very quickly. I did point out last time I was on the show that the United States' origins, the colonies' origins, were as corporations, given governmental powers by the British monarchy. And you see that with the Massachusetts Bay Company and of course the Hudson Bay Company and even the East India Company in India that actually took over the Indian subcontinent, the giving of eminent domain powers to the pipeline, to the Dakota Access Pipeline, is really in that tradition, giving a commercial project governmental abilities. And when we were fighting the KXL fight, we had a lot of allies, but it's been hard here. But I see that we're running out of time.
Yeah, we only have 30 seconds left.
All right.
That's a subject for another show. United States-based origins as a commercial colony. Thank you, Jacqueline. And thank you,
Thanks,
all your
Paul.
Listeners. This is KBOO Community Radio, Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks for listening.